Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And as undoubtedly all of you know very, very well, Tuesday was a big election day here in the state of Wisconsin. And if you somehow missed it on Tuesday, you certainly didn't miss the weeks of saturation of the airwaves of all kinds of political ads. And of course, the whole country's eyes were focused on Wisconsin because essentially we were the only game in town on Tuesday, the only significant primary being played out anywhere in the presidential race. And there were other important elections as well. And I'm really glad to have with me today on the morning show two faculty colleagues from Carthage College, Jeff Roberg, who is professor of political science and chair of the political science department, and Jerry Mast, associate professor of political science. They have joined us on any number of occasions, and I'm delighted to have both of them back to talk about Tuesday, what those numbers look like, placing them in context of a much longer race, and maybe even getting them to offer some thoughts on what might possibly be ahead in what is turning out to be a turbulent and rather unpredictable presidential race. Certainly one of the most intriguing/disturbing in maybe a whole long, long, long time. Professor Roberg, Professor Mast, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Gregory.
Good to have all of you here. Jerry Mast, when you first got to the studio today, one of your thoughts that you thought might be a good place to start today was placing this in the context of a conversation that we had a little earlier this year around the theme of insurgency and how this presidential race is, in a sense, sort of a season of insurgency and surging and ebbing and flowing of this insurgency that's to varying degrees on both sides of the aisle. Say a little more about that.
Yeah. Back in January, we met in the wake of the Iowa caucuses, and I thought that one of the themes that emerged in our conversation then was that this electoral cycle is a season of insurgency. Both parties are confronting the campaigns of candidates who are challenging the establishment, challenging kind of conventional party positions. Then we said that that this insurgency seems to be stronger on the Republican side, although clearly many of us underestimated the strength of Senator Sanders. And I think that in the weeks that have passed since then, much of what we talked about was borne out. Trump has fared very well. And Sanders has done, you know, moderately well, certainly better than conventional expectations would have put it. So then this kind of brings us to Wisconsin, and Wisconsin, I think, has been the focus of a lot of attention for the reasons you laid out in the opening. We are the only game in town, kind of sitting all by ourselves. And so the key players at this point really did focus hard on Wisconsin. I think that the theme of insurgency still lives, but it's been modified a little bit. So on the Republican side, where insurgency has been, I think, thriving, Wisconsin Republicans set it back a bit, dampened those forces. And on the Democratic side, where the insurgency was kind of moving along but still maybe not moving as fast as it needed to go, it got a bolt or a surge of support. This is all very complicated, right? There's many factors that explain why insurgencies seem to be playing well this year. I think there's many factors explaining why Wisconsin did what it did. Polarization is a powerful factor there that has had different effects. But so I think, you know, that's kind of this when I look at what's going on, those are the kinds of things that stand out to me.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense?
It does. I think we've got a number of different aspects here, and on the Republican side, if we're talking about the insurgent candidacies, plural, again, as we talked before going on air, you know, Cruz just a couple of months ago was considered an insurgent as well, just as Trump. I think as far as the quote-unquote establishment rallying around Cruz at this point in time, it's not a we support Cruz, it's a we want to stop Trump.
That's absolutely right. So I think, you know, if we could look at some historical analogs, you know, the Republican Party has a choice between a kind of a modern day George Wallace and a modern day Barry Goldwater.
Right.
Two very unorthodox, well, different kinds of orthodox, unorthodoxness or heterodoxy.
Yeah.
But absolutely correct.
And certainly the policies of Senator Cruz don't necessarily line up with where the Republican Party or part of the Republican Party is at this point in time. If we're looking, you know, there's on the economic side of things and also, for that matter, some of the social aspects at this point in time.
I would say that Senator Cruz's politics and policies are – and maybe this is the oxymoron, a kind of conventional Tea Party perspective, right? And so in a way, he is the manifestation of the Tea Party's ascendancy within the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. But Donald Trump has made it easy in that regard, right?
Absolutely.
When you don't put actual policy positions out, or if you have a position, but you then don't show how it can carry out, and so the amount of paper that we have, so to speak, supporting some of his positions is minimal, then you make it relatively easy.
Right. Hmm.
At this point, I wanted to make sure to give you the chance to talk about the state of Wisconsin to help us kind of put what happened Tuesday into some proper perspective. It was actually today on Morning Edition that there was a story that I'm sure a lot of our listeners heard about Hillary Clinton and women voters, and to what extent she is showing strength or maybe some slightly deteriorating strength when it comes to women voters across the country in comparison to other candidates. But in the course of that conversation where they were talking about how actually in Wisconsin she didn't do all that well with women compared to some earlier primaries, whoever Jim Inskeep was talking to basically said, well, on the other hand, Wisconsin is a bit of an outlier. So, in a sense, we shouldn't make sweeping generalizations based on what the women of Wisconsin did with their votes for Hillary Clinton. I thought it would be interesting to just take a moment to talk about the most important ways in which Wisconsin is an outlier. I mean, that there are things relatively unique about Wisconsin, which, in a sense, mean that we have to be cautious about the sort of conclusions we draw about what happened here on Tuesday and whether or not they have much, if any, relevancy in terms of the nation as a whole. How much are we not a reflection of the nation as a whole, but just a reflection of who we happen to be? So what do you think are the most important ways in which we are an outlier, if you think that's a appropriate way to think of this state?
Yeah, I think it is. I would say you know, we can touch upon similarities and differences between Wisconsin and the rest of the country. So the differences really, I think, are differences of degree. And I started out talking about polarization, and I'll continue with that thread. I think that while the country is becoming more polarized, in Wisconsin, I think that polarization is even more intense than most every other place. So, and I think that the data bears this out. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's exit poll shows that the share of moderates on the Republican side voting in the primary and the share of moderates in the Democratic side voting in this year's primary both shrunk from previous years, 1 in 4, roughly speaking, voters on either side characterized themselves as moderates. Those characterizing themselves as very liberal or very conservative all grew. So that's going on.
So let me just clarify that. So you're not saying that the moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans stayed home. You're saying they, in a sense, became not moderates.
Or some combination of both, okay. Right? So some combination of both. Although conversion might be the better hypothesis, given that the turnout was, you know, as high as it's been since 1972.
Right.
Since the turnout was
right.
very high for a primary.
So those people didn't disappear. Their
right.
sense of moderation
their
disappeared.
Their expression seemed to be, or the way they're identifying themselves seems to be changing. And so I think that this polarization that takes place is taking place in Wisconsin has had a couple of interesting effects. One is that it creates fertile ground for Senator Sanders, who is clearly more liberal than the average American. And he what his message, his criticism of the political economy, is resonating with very liberal, very progressive voters. And so Wisconsin is different from the rest of the country because we have a very large critical pool of progressive voters, but we also have a very large, you know, critical mass of very conservative voters as well. So there aren't that many swing states. So in that sense, we're different. Wisconsin is a swing state. We're a swing state not because we're moderate, not because, you know, we're middle of the road kind of community. We are a swing state because we have these very significant but comparably sized polls, right? So it's fertile ground for Sanders on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, I think that polarization in Wisconsin worked oddly against Trump, and that is that you know, Wisconsin is the birthplace of the Republican Party. It is the we have a very longer than any other state tradition of Republican politics. The party organization is very strong in Wisconsin. The chair of the Republican National Committee is a Wisconsinite. The Speaker of the House is a Wisconsinite. And we've had a Republican governor now since 2010. He's withstood a historic challenge and recall. He's really galvanized Republicans in this state. And so the polarization that's taking place on the Republican side has not moved them away from establishment politics, because establishment politics in Wisconsin has moved in a very Tea Party direction. So the Walker administration and the Republican legislature have been governing since 2010 almost entirely for the base, for the Republican base. So there's not this anti-establishment politics in Wisconsin like there is in many other parts of the country, because the insurgency, right, the Republican insurgency is in some sense found a happy home in Madison.
Hmm.
So Trump comes in, right? He comes onto the stage, lambasting this Republican Party establishment politics. And, you know, that kind of plays like he sounds like a Democrat in Wisconsin, because our Republican establishment has been very conservative. And there's not much, if any, Republican discontent with the way things have been going in Wisconsin.
Right. So, for instance, when Trump speaks critically of Governor Walker, as he did.
That's bad politics in Wisconsin.
Or
for a Republican.
Right,
a Republican.
Or bad strategy, campaign strategy. Right.
No, I would agree with everything that Jerry has said. I'm going to take it a slightly different angle in terms of going forward, and that is this polarization is not just Democratic-Republican polarization. The exit polls, I would argue, show us something else that's going on in Wisconsin itself. And that is, if we look at who Sanders voters will support come the general election and versus who Hillary supporters will support come the general election, we can talk the same in terms of Cruz and Trump. There's a large distrust of the other candidate within the same party. So Bernie voters, roughly 80% or so, are not, you know, in the past we've had this kind of view of, okay, your person doesn't win the primary. Who do you vote for in November? And then you say, okay, well, it's the lesser of two evils. My person didn't win, but I will support the Democrat over the Republican, or I will support the Republican over the Democrat because of X, right, that the alternative is worse. I'm not sure that it plays out as usual this time around. And in both, again, now if Wisconsin is a one-off, then, you know, I'll be back in a couple of weeks with you, and you can tell me I'm wrong after New York, and that's fine. I'm good with that. But if we're not special in this regard, then I think all the campaigns have something to be concerned about when it comes to turnout at the end of it. I mean, it's fair to say that those are people who are strong Sanders supporters. Right, they're feeling the burn, and they're very committed. Same with Hillary's supporters. And again, we still see the same divide in terms of, you know, who will do better on foreign policy, who can you trust, right? Those kind of questions. That is consistent countrywide in terms of that. But for me at least, this time out, and again, it may be a one-off. It seems to me that the positions of the supporters of whether it's on the Democratic side or on the Republican side has hardened. And I'm not sure how many of those will actually flip.
I think that those are critically important questions. I think that the chasm to be bridged is much bigger on the Republican side than on the Democratic
Agreed.
Side. And I would also point out that, you know, we're in the midst of a – you know, pretty competitive primary contest. And so mm-hmm. I think it's only natural that feelings are intense and people are likely to be expressing, you know, distrust or an unwillingness to move, to unite, right? The conventional role of conventions, at least the role of conventions in modern times,
right,
has been to engage in this process of reconciliation to bring the party back together. And I think that the Democrats are positioned probably in a way that they'll be able to do that. Well, it's not entirely clear. I think still the odds look very good for Senator or Secretary Clinton to arrive at where she needs to as far as the delegates are concerned. And when that point comes and when the convention comes, much will hinge on how Senator Sanders handles it, right? So mm-hmm. So what does Senator Sanders say? How does the Clinton camp reach out to the progressive wing of the party? She's given every indication of being willing to accommodate it mm-hmm. at this point. It's absolutely true that the Clinton campaign should be concerned, no question. But the level of concern is much lower, I would say, than it should be in the Sanders camp, and not even in the same ballpark of what's going on the Republican side.
Well, I think that's fair. The one caveat I would have is, and this has ebbed and flowed throughout the primary season as well, is the nature of the arguments that, particularly on the Democratic side right now, between Sanders and Clinton. Have ratcheted up, right? And we can argue about fairness of arguments or unfairness of arguments and accuracy and all of that. Nonetheless, the arguments are being made. And so it seems to me that hard feelings, if you will, are also
going to grow.
And so you're absolutely right. I agree with you completely in terms of what the convention, modern conventions, are supposed to do. And we'll see some version of that. The question is, you know, what happens? If we take 2008 as an example, right, because feelings were pretty hard between Obama and Clinton in 2008, then, yes, feelings kind of, you know, chill out, and then we kind of go from
there. I can think of one factor that kind of works in Clinton's favor towards being able to reconcile eventually the party, and one factor that works against it, and the factor that works against it is that she has really failed to get traction amongst younger voters. And younger voters have, in the last 10-12 years, become a really important demographic. They've become an important demographic because in 2008, right, President Obama was able to mobilize them to get them to turn out in record levels. And you know, historically, they've been almost an afterthought because they've not been reliable. They haven't been able to turn out. but they have turned out at the presidential level, not at the midterm level, but at the presidential level, and that has worked really. They've become very important to the Democratic strategy, and if this group that has rallied wholesale behind Senator Sanders decides to sit it out, well then for sure. The Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party have a real problem on their hands. The fact they're working in their favor, of course, is that racial minorities, have solidly aligned themselves with Clinton. They've become also a critical constituency for the mm-hmm. Democratic Party, and all signs indicate they'll be there in November.
Yeah, and with young folks, right? We're talking about. Just give your listeners a sense of roughly a fifth of the voting population at this point, fifth, a touch more.
Yeah.
So traditionally, if we go back, say, 15 years ago or so, and before, we're talking about, give or take, 25% turnout among that group for, 18 to 24-year-olds, which, of course, is outnumbered tremendously, right, by 50 and up, let alone 65 and up, mm-hmm. By in the ranges of, as I like to tell students, their grandparents vote in the range of about 70% or so that turn out.
Well, and they're outnumbered to start with.
Right.
I mean, even before we talk about percentage of turnout, there's just so many more older people than younger people. That's just mathematically the reality, let alone then when you stir in the factor of who shows up at the poll most faithfully or most assuredly.
Right. Sure.
Of course, we could be talking about what is the ability of Senator Sanders to reconcile, the party
right.
should he win. But right now, the math is kind of daunting. He's going to need, upper 50s, 60% of the delegates in key states like New York, California, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. And those states are demographically a much harder road to hoe for him.
Right.
Now, Senator Sanders should take some solace out of Wisconsin in particular, because across the board in Wisconsin, he did pretty well among all age groups and still has an issue mostly being with white voters as such. But at least on the age group level, he was able – something he wasn't able to do in Florida, for instance.
Age group, education group, income
right.
group, right? I mean, he really won.
Right.
But he didn't win right. racial minorities that's at this point, I would say, kind of a key Achilles heel for him.
Hmm. Although traditionally, right, this is why we whoever the nominee happens to be, this is what goes into that choice of VP, right? How do we balance?
Hmm. Right.
I'm sure there have to be people in the Clinton campaign who are right now pulling their hair out, trying to figure out what is a way that she can connect better with younger voters. What do you think the issue is right now? Is it just that she's going up against somebody who has this sort of magical touch with younger voters and she is just losing out by comparison? Or is there something more specific going on here about who she is or what she represents?
I think there's some specific factors. And those factors are that younger people are going to be more idealistic. They're going to have less historical knowledge of the political system, less institutional knowledge of the political system, and so they're more open to a kind of an idealistic kind of candidate. They're also more economically vulnerable than any other demographic. So young people are at a very kind of precarious position economically, especially. At those hotbeds of Sanders support, colleges and universities, right? So they're a group of young people, idealistic, worried about their economic futures, the debt that they're taking on, and Senator Sanders' campaign seems to be very much designed to go after that mm-hmm. group of people, and it's working very well. On the other side of the coin, Senator and Secretary Clinton has been in the game for a very, very long time. She comes from the Democratic Leadership Council tradition of so-called New Democrats back from the 80s that pulled the party more to the center in response to the Reagan administration. And so she's aligned herself with more business interests than a person like Sanders. And so she's in a tough spot, I think, in terms of the broader context, the way in which the economy's evolved. And she's in a tough spot with respect to the way the Democratic Party has evolved. And she's in a tough spot with respect to the kind of the current conditions or situations of young people in particular. So she's had to kind of reinvent her politics a little bit to account for these changes. And, of course, that reinvention has fueled the criticism of her as kind of inauthentic or you know, a politician with her finger in the wind, right, trying to figure out where the currents are, which, of course, you know, hardly sets her apart.
Right, right. It's not like she's the only person prone to that kind of conduct. I'm reminded, as you describe what the attractiveness of Senator Sanders is for younger voters, of a couple of faculty colleagues who went to his rally and who happened to be very strong supporters of him, although I'm not certain both of them would vote for him versus Hillary, but feel very good about who he is and what he stands for. But as they talked about the rally, one of them said, you know, I loved the what, but I sure wish we'd heard a little bit of how, in terms of what some would characterize as rather lavish promises being made, and almost not a single word about how such things could possibly be enacted or implemented without bankrupting the country, or just how to bring them about at all. And I thought that was just really kind of interesting because I mean, I talked to all kinds of students. I mean, 2/3 of my voice students were at that rally and loved every minute of it. I didn't hear any of them stop to say, where was the how? Or I mean, and I suppose they're a little less apt to maybe ask those kind of questions. And maybe that kind of event isn't about that anyway. But
well, that's I think the crux of the problem for a campaign like Senator Sanders. Let's be clear. Our political environment is not conducive to effective governance. Our institutional structure, the constitutional structure that we have, makes governance very difficult to begin with. But the current political environment makes it next to impossible. And so, you know, a very fair question would be, what are the prospects of a President Clinton doing, you know, being extraordinarily effective? So, right. You know, I mean, I think is a very, very, very fair point. The real challenge for someone like Sanders, of course, is that he's laying out a vision that is predicated on dramatic changes in the political environment, right? He keeps talking about a political revolution, and the revolution he's talking about, of course, is a revolution in political behavior. Turnout has to change in significant ways. Realignment almost has to happen. Mm-hmm. And I would say that those kinds of campaigns can, in fact, change the political environment. But it's a process of change that plays out over decades, not a matter of months, for the most part. A good historical analog would be, you know, Adlai Stevenson, who ran for the Democratic nomination a number of times and failed to win the presidency. And yet, if you look at – so the historian Arthur Schlesinger has pointed to Adlai Stevenson as saying, Stevenson is the reason why we have had a Jack Kennedy. He's the reason why the or not the reason, but one of the key reasons why the Democratic Party shifted as it did on issues like civil rights and so forth and the environment. And so, you know, I think that Senator Sanders isn't a Don Quixote tilting with windmills in the sense that he can, in fact, change the political culture. He can, in fact, change the political environment. But he's very unlikely to change it in a matter of months or even a couple years, to the extent that the political system, the political government, the government that we have, will be able to deliver on anything close to what it is that he's talking about.
Right. So he might end up changing the country, but perhaps not change it as president,
absolutely.
But just as someone who is raising extraordinarily revolutionary ideas.
You could
see the
exact same thing on the other side, right? So Senator Cruz, right, is going to be no le- more able to deliver on the kinds of things that he's, you know, promising the primary voters on the Republican side than Senator Sanders would be, right? So he's laying out a vision of conservatism for the country that might have an impact, you know, down the road, but he would not be able to deliver in a practical sense were he to win the White House.
And this brings us, you know, back full circle in terms of polarization, right? In terms of where we are and where we've been and where we're going.
Right.
And so the
and the realities of incrementalism
right.
within the governmental structure.
And so in terms of the parties themselves, right, the Democrats are moving certainly at this point in time and for the last, you know, 10 years or so, more and more left as you know, certain, you know, or 15, I guess it is now, right, in relationship to the Iraq War and Afghanistan and such, certainly moving more and more left. The Republicans, we're seeing them move more and more to the right. The Republican, you know, lessons that were learned from the last couple of elections was not that we need to be more moderate, but, right, and I think Cruz typifies this, right, that we need to stick to our principles. We need to make that principled argument and go out there to win the day as such. And so we've got those kind of lessons happening, so we've got this kind of pulling apart, if you will. But at the same time, in both camps, and I'm a little loath to put Trump as the practical realist in the Republican Party, but that's kind of the role he is at the moment.
In ways he is.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
We've got these kind of it's very interesting how it's all played out. So to back up for just a minute, you know, campaign 101 would tell you, you know, every candidate has to figure out why it is that they're running. What's the purpose? Why am I doing this? Why do I want to get my family involved? What's my message?
Right.
And as Jerry rightly noted before, Bernie Sanders has this message. You know, you can like it, you cannot like it, but it's certainly caught on. There's a grand vision of what his campaign is at least trying to accomplish, and we can argue about
it. Right, and it's unmistakable.
Right, and we can argue about the hows and the issues that may exist there. For Hillary Clinton, her campaign has been struggling, as back to your question a while ago of you know, why am I here, right? And there's I'm a technocrat, if you will. I'm good at doing these kind of things. I can, you know, the kind of policies that we're seeing, I think, you know, when we think about the youth voter, you asked what is it that's, you know, caught on about Sanders. So Sanders at our event at Carthage, as well as, you know, nationwide, has been saying free education, right, for public, you know, right.
Universal health care,
right.
Single right. payer.
Sound great.
Renewable energy for
right?
everybody.
You know, who can't get behind this stuff, right? But then you get into the problem, you know, versus, I'll phrase it that way, Hillary Clinton, who says, we have to do something about student debt.
Right.
You know, we need to be able to refinance loans, right? So that, you know, if you can refinance your house, if you can refinance this, why can't you refinance your student debt? That's a much more complicated message.
Right.
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 It's certainly not as catchy.
It's less romantic.
It's less right. sexy, if you will. Right.
Doesn't fit on a sign.
It's hard to put that there. Right. So that's an issue. Now, there's obviously Achilles' heels again in terms of Senator Sanders. We're not hearing almost anything on foreign policy except for right. The pivot when he got to Michigan of trade. Right.
Right.
So we have trade in terms of the trade deals and NAFTA and TPP and others. And then we've got certainly the war question there, right? And I think we're all overselling that in terms of campaigning. But all right, on the Republican side, we've got some kind of different issues that are happening.
Yeah, on the Republican side, I think it's interesting this issue of trying to sell bitter pills that reflect a more realistic approach to, to governance. Kenosha's own, right? Ryan Priebus and a number of other, you know, smart, well-informed tacticians sat down after 2012 and you know, looked at the data and said, Republican Party's got to be more diverse. We've got to reach out beyond older white male demographic that is, for the most part, the sweet spot for the GOP.
And that's gone now.
Yeah. So we need to they wrote a report, right? That report, it can be found on the internet. You can read it. They said we need to be more moderate on key issues for social issues. We've got to moderate our rhetoric and our policy positions when it comes to abortion and women's rights and reaching out to the poor. And we have to reach out to different demographic groups, in particular Hispanics, who I would argue are a kind of a natural target for the Republican
right.
Party if they were really serious about
right.
it. But all of that strategizing, all of that kind of planning was for naught. I mean, literally for naught.
Donald Trump evidently didn't read that report.
Donald Trump threw a
didn't
massive
get the
wrench.
Memo.
Threw a massive wrench into those plans.
Interesting.
So, I mean, it's the same kind of dynamic of people who kind of understand the complexity of the electorate and the challenges associated with governance, trying to craft the politics that's conducive to it. But that kind of politics involves some hard things to swallow for key groups, particularly in the bases of a polarizing party system.
And they just don't want to do that.
No, they certainly don't.
It was interesting, though, with the Wisconsin exit polls, at least, that, you know, again, maybe Wisconsin's a one-off. Maybe, you know, in part because of that horrible week he had. You know, I guess it's now 2 weeks ago. but he's leveled off again in terms of support. So his support across all age groups and incomes and whatnot is again at about that one-third aspect.
Well, so I mean, I did a little bit of looking at the data for where people stand. According to the aggregated polling numbers at Real Clear Politics, the current distribution of support nationally for Trump, Cruz, and Kasich in that order is 40%, 33%, 20%. So, you know, maybe what's happened in Wisconsin hasn't really kind of played out yet. At the national level, that could be. But I would say that you know, Trump has been able to maintain, I think, a clear leadership position nationally in terms of the numbers. Cruz is catching up. The question is, how quickly can he catch up? My guess is he probably can't catch up to him to pass him in the
right.
delegate vote. He can't, I think. I think we can say safely, regardless, not of what Cruz himself says, he can't capture the 1,237 delegates. He needs like 90% of the delegates left to do that. Even Trump is in a difficult spot to do it. He needs 60-some percent of the delegates left. So I think clearly we're headed for a contested and probably a brokered convention on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, Clinton has, you know, almost 50% average nationally, and Sanders is at around 44. So, again, he's been moving up, trying to catch her. He hasn't done it yet, at least in terms of the national numbers. That's not how we elect or nominate people. But
right.
it does reflect kind of what the public's nationally sentiments are. And he's unlikely to catch her either, I think.
Right. One thing I want to be sure to ask you about is when it comes to the specific numbers of what played out here in Wisconsin, one of the most dramatic points we've already talked about it is, in a sense, what probably felt to some people like a repudiation of Donald Trump. I mean, the fact that he lost to Ted Cruz so decisively, although he...
Except in some, not in some places of the state, right?
Right.
Like Kenosha County.
Right. And that's what I wanted to ask you about. And it was a colleague here at the station, actually, who raised kind of an interesting theory, that being that because when you look at the total number of votes cast in the presidential race in Kenosha, it was almost exactly even between
right.
Democrats and Republicans. But, of course, traditionally, that's not this population. There are more Democrats than Republicans here. So his theory was that you had a fair number of Democrats who actually crossed over and voted for Donald Trump, not so much because of their affinity with him, but because they wanted him to win, because they want him to be the Republican candidate, because he would be a far more vulnerable candidate. First of all, I guess I just want to ask you about that theory, or if you have other theories on why Donald Trump happened to do so well here in Kenosha, and on the other hand, did not do very well in the state overall at all.
I can say it, I know it to be definitively true on some level, right? Because I know some Democrats who did just as Mr. McGrath was hypothesizing.
You mean personally?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Ah. Right. The question, I guess, is how many? Was it enough? Was it more than just an occasional person here or there who did it? If it's just an occasional person here or there then did it, well, so what? I mean, it's probably canceled out by, you know, a Republican crossing over to vote for the less likely Democrat or the weaker Democrat. I would argue, though, that if we look at the research, so there is some research on crossover voting, and Wisconsin has an open primary, and so Wisconsin actually is the subject of some of that research. So looking at some work that's looked at Wisconsin from the 60s up into, you know, early 90s on crossover voting tends to involve, it's hard to measure for sure, but somewhere on the order of, you know, between 5 and 14, 15%, you know, so an average of maybe 8, 9, 10% is you get crossover. Some of that is strategic, that is to say going across the line to vote for what you perceive to be the weaker of the other party's candidates. But some of it is authentic or legitimate in the sense that you have people kind of in the middle who are what political scientists call cross-pressured, right? Mm. You know, you like the Republicans for some things, you like the Democrats for others. You identify primarily as a Democrat, though, or as a Republican, though. Right? But occasionally you go over and vote on the other side of the aisle. I would say that Kenosha is the kind of place where, you know, Trump has some natural appeal. You know, Kenosha's got a storied history of industrialism, right? Nash and AMC and Rambler and then Chrysler. And we are a town that made things, mm-hmm. where, you know, you could have a comfortable existence as a blue-collar worker. Right, a comfortable middle class existence, and so, as we all here know, that economy has shifted. It has changed, and so I think those claims that Kenosha has picked itself up, that has been able to move forward, are legitimate enough. But not everybody has felt that equally, right? So there are going to be pockets of people in Kenosha for whom the kind of the Kenosha recovery, so to speak, hasn't been felt all that well, and so there's anxiety and concern there. And those are going to be kind of blue-collar people, blue-collar white people for the most part, and blue-collar white people who are union members or union sympathizers, if not union members, who are very concerned about worker rights, who are more culturally conservative, more socially conservative. And so they're kind of pulled in those opposite directions. And I think that the Trump phenomenon is a reflection of the Republican Party's inability to satisfy folks like that, to keep them convinced that the Republican Party has their best interests in mind. So I think that there's probably a significant number of people who are naturally inclined to support someone like Mr. Trump.
Hmm. I'd agree with a lot of what Jerry said here. Make a couple of other aspects too, and that is, so you in your opening question you asked, or you phrased it as more Democrats than Republicans. City, that's correct. County has shifted a lot over the last decade or two.
Right.
And if we widen it out to the first congressional district, even more in that regard. So you're certainly correct that there's no Democrat that should lose Kenosha City.
Right.
The county, though, is much more up for grabs in that regard. And so we've seen a lot of shifting. And in that in the narrative that Jerry gave in terms of blue collar, certainly accurate. But because of some of the shifting that we've seen in the city and the county in general, we also have a lot more white collar moving in, right? The Chicago corridor effect, if you will. Mm-hmm. And a number of those folks came out and supported Trump as well. I think Jerry hit it exactly right in terms of the cross voters and such. The only other thing I would say is, right, and it kind of gives us a little bit of a support for this idea of city versus county, is if we look at Antrimian, right, so the mayoral election, what you have there is, you know, roughly a two-third to one-third vote in terms of supporting Antrimian. Now, part of that, of course, is name recognition, right?
Incumbent advantage.
Right,
yeah.
You know, even though
he wasn't an incumbent,
technically,
but he's kind of an incumbent.
But he's,
yeah.
But, you know, right, so you get all of those advantages as such. But still, right, at the end of the day, the voters, you know, because of the turnout that was there, they had to decide who we going for here. And Wisconsin is blessed that we have a rather highly educated political public. And what I mean by that is that, you know, so we have traditionally some of the highest voting totals throughout the country that you know, Wisconsinites turn out. I mean, granted, this primary was higher than it, you know, one would normally expect.
Yeah.
But even so, even in primary times, we do pretty well.
Right. Right. But there are still differences, and I think that kind of explains the seeming oddness of what happened in Kenosha. And that is, say, in primary season or in midterms, Republicans have an advantage in Wisconsin.
Right.
Right. And so the what you would expect in Kenosha. It's going to be muted because this is a primary or a midterm. The numbers will shift back a bit come general election in a presidential year.
I think the key is also, right, if we look at, and I haven't done this myself, maybe you have, in terms of the votes for the state Supreme Court race, right, in terms of how that turned out in terms of the county here. Versus what?
No, I didn't. I haven't broken it down by county level. I haven't seen any of that data.
I would be remiss if I didn't at least quickly ask you about the Racine School Board, if you followed that at all, but the fact that Racine was directed to shift the way that the school board was elected. I mean, that was a direction from Madison, that it would be split into districts, and the presumption was that it was hoping that there would be less support of the teachers' union from that newly elected school board, and just the opposite happened. The majority actually were those candidates supported by the teachers' union. So that appears to be a strategy in Madison that did not work out as planned.
You know, I did not follow that, I'm hesitant to offer interpretation.
Let's hear it for somebody who feels hesitant in this election.
I'm in the same boat. If you must have something, I'm going to switch topic on you, and that is there's one name we haven't mentioned in this whole hour, and that's Kasich.
Yeah.
True.
There's a reason.
We heard his name a lot, but mostly in Ted Cruz ads telling voters not to vote for Kasich because it was essentially a vote for Trump.
And Club for Growth was out there against him as well.
Yeah, I think that his presence at this point is justified in that, you know, we've kind of identified Cruz as a candidate that people are embracing more because they don't care for Trump. Obviously, Cruz has his natural supporters, but it doesn't reflect the level of support he got in Wisconsin. What is the best strategy for stopping Trump from reaching 1237 with Kasich in the game or without him? And I